This is Scott Stender, and he will be speaking on attacking internationalized software.
Thank you for the introduction. So, like you just heard, I will be speaking about attacking internationalized software. And you might ask, who are you and why are you talking about internationalized software and what is it? Well, I am a founding partner of Information Security Partners, ISEC Partners, and we are a security consultancy. We are based out of the United States, and we gave this. I gave the same talk at Black Hat Las Vegas in the summer, and I'm happy to have been invited back. In my day-to-day job, I'm an application security consultant and researcher. Oftentimes, I spend my days doing these kind of attacks for our clients. And you might wonder why you have to listen to this talk. Every application, including those that are explicitly internationalized and those that are not, are internationalized because of core standards. This is some, when I say core standard, I mean like HTTP, XML, and a lot of things upon which our software is built today all have internationalization built into those standards. Because of this broad cross-application, cross-platform, cross-language attack surface, this topic has a lot of research potential. If you're a software developer, it also has a great attack surface that you have to worry about. Now, I just mentioned that internationalization is a cross-platform concern. In this talk, I'm going to use mostly Windows for examples. That's just because it lends itself to easy examples. There are plenty of internationalization concerns in other applications and platforms and operating systems. So to go through this topic, we're going to first start with internationalization background. Now, when I gave this talk last time, it was a long portion, and it was very technically deep, and it's a tough one to get through for all of us. I promise I'll keep it as short and painless as possible, but it is necessary to understand the attacks I'll discuss later on in the speech. And after that, we'll go to the historical attacks. Every time I mention this research interest of mine to other people, the first thing they say is, oh yes, like that IS4 vuln. Actually, I got that about 5 minutes ago from one of my fellow speakers. That is one of the attacks that has been researched before. I'll go over it briefly and a couple of others, and move on to current attacks. These are things that have been the focus of my personal research for a number of years. It has seen some more attention in the security community. I'll talk over a couple of things that people have found recently. And then a couple of attack patterns I've seen less used in attacking software and even lesser used in defending it. Finally, I have a tool that I'll demo called I18N Attack, which is shorthand for Internationalization Attack. And it is a tool that will help automate some of the basic internationalization attacks that I described here. After that, we'll have a time for questions and answers. You can either ask me from the floor, or I understand there'll be a table outside where there'll be a translator, and you'll be able to ask me questions directly at that time. So let's launch into the background. So what is internationalization? Well, internationalization is kind of a catch-all phrase for anything that is required in order to build cross-locale support into your software system. And so because that's a catch-all phrase, it's hard to describe exactly what it is. A lot of people think of character manipulation. I'm from the United States, and I speak in a language that has a very limited alphabet, 26 letters, 10 numbers, and so on. So it's very easy to encode my language, a very small code page. It doesn't require a lot of binary data to encode an English sentence, or an English letter anyway. Here in Japan, it has to have many more characters. And being able to support both of those in the same software system is something that is an interesting concern for people who are creating software. that, by chance, is that also the focus of this talk, since characters are often what we're interested in. Every application is built upon, input. It acts upon that input, translates that input. And therefore, it's of an interesting research topic for bypassing security protections. There are other parts of internationalization. Other things would include taking into account locale-specific preferences, things like how currency is displayed. Is it with a dollar sign, or a yen sign, or a euro sign? Things like how you sort data. Things like how you represent the decimal point in a number that is a fraction. All that is defined by locale-specific settings. And though there is some interesting attack surface there, it's a little less so than the character manipulation. So what do I mean when I say character manipulation? Well, we all know that computers are simple machines that take in data as ones and zeros. A series of on and off switches. All a computer can do is understand that those ones and zeros represent semantic data. And manipulating how that data is interpreted is sometimes just as interesting as submitting different data itself. Now, because of all the world's data, how varied it is, there are a number of standards of how to encode text. By that I mean sentences, characters, and various locales. One common example taught to computer science students, at least across the United States, is ASCII. ASCII is a simple code page that can encode English sentences and characters very efficiently. And here is an example of the ASCII code page. So if you look at the top row, those will be the least significant bytes or bits, and the left column is the most significant bits. And if you OR them together on a given character space, that is the hexadecimal representation of that character. So if we were to, for example, look over here at this location, we would see that that is lead byte or lead 4 bits 2, trail 2 bits 7, and that's hex 27, which is the apostrophe character. Similarly, we have... Thank you. Very helpful. Similarly, we have the Latin capital letter A, which is hexadecimal 41. Capital letter B is right next to it. And you'll see that I'm using hexadecimal in general for my examples. You know, if it helps you think about it, there's all the ones and zeros switched on and off. But from here on out, I will refer to characters and their full hexadecimal representation. Now, one distinction I want to get across early in the talk is what a code page is and what encoding is. A code page is a collection of characters, a certain standard. And a character is a piece of semantic data. Code pages you might have heard of would include Unicode. And Unicode, by chance, is what most people think of when they think of internationalization. And if you want to look at things that predate Unicode, you'll see a lot of single byte and multi-byte code pages. A single byte is usually sufficient to encode a given European language, like English or Italian or German. And so you'll often see that those code pages are represented with 8 bits for a total of 256 characters. There are also multi-byte code pages. Reason why is a lot of computer scientists realized they needed more than just 8 bits to encode a language like Japanese. A lot more than 256 characters. But at the same time, they wanted to maintain compatibility with those single byte code pages. So what you'll see are these multi-byte patterns, where a given character will be encoded with either 1 or 2 or more bytes. And examples of multi-byte patterns would be Japanese SHIP-JIS, also many Chinese and Korean code pages. So like I said, a code page is just a collection of characters. Encoding is how we interpret that collection into ones and zeros. So here are a number of example encodings. First two, EBCDIC and ASCII, are often used interchangeably as both a code page and an encoding. This is because it is rather simple to associate a number with an efficient encoding of those code pages. In Unicode, however, we still want to maintain efficiency but support a much larger code page, which is why we see a number of Unicode-based encodings. Key thing to remember is that each one of those Unicode encodings is used to represent the same code page. They're just alternate ways of supplying ones and zeros for the same semantic data. So here's an example of a multi-byte code page. And I'm going to focus here because there are a couple of attack patterns which are reliant upon it. Now, like I said, there's a couple of common multi-byte code pages that especially you will see. There's SHIP-JIS, which is a Japanese encoding, and also UTF-8, which is a multi-byte encoding for Unicode. And you'll see that each one of these code pages represents a byte. If I want to encode something in ASCII, then there's a one-to-one mapping between ASCII and SHIP-JIS. For example, there's a Latin capital letter A. If you remember from the example earlier, ASCII A was also 41. So like I said, the intent here is to maintain compatibility with the heavily used ASCII code page. So things like SQL and HTML and other data whose meta characters are simple ASCII punctuation don't have to have a lot of additional interpretation. However, if we want to start encoding more data than just what can fit there, what they do is use a lead byte, trail byte pattern. So you'll see here towards the middle of the code page and the bottom of the code page, there are these sections that are grayed out. Those sections are reserved, those bytes are reserved, as lead bytes. Any parser that is interpreting a SHIP-JIS must take into account that lead byte is not a character unto itself. It is a character only when mapped to an appropriate trail byte. So here in the red that I've highlighted is a character, which if you were to look it up in the Unicode code page would be Unicode 2032. But as represented in SHIP-JIS is a multi-byte pattern. The first byte is hex 81, and that maps to a follow-up page, which we have here. And the follow-up byte is hex 8C. So if we were to encode that in SHIP-JIS, Unicode 2032, which semantically is the prime character, is actually hex 81, hex 8C. Sorry to throw so many binary numbers your way, but it gets better, I promise you. Any questions about that at this point before I move on? All right. So Unicode is an attempt to unify all of the world's characters into a single code page. And that's a number of characters. It's not only, you know, things that we might find in our programming world day to day, things like, you know, Latin alphabets and, you know, Japanese characters, Chinese characters. They also seek to encode dead languages like Sanskrit, things that people don't speak anymore. But there are academics out there that still read it and write it for their work, and they want to be able to write it into computers. And so encoding not only all the world's live languages, but also the dead ones, and also leave room for the future ones, is quite an undertaking. Now, like I said, Unicode is a 21-bit encoding space. Though often when you mention Unicode to a programmer, they think of one of two things. If you're talking to a web developer, they might think of UTF-8. That's a standard encoding used in a lot of web transports. So if you're talking to a C developer on Windows, they'd probably think of 16-bit characters, or because the core support for internationalization in Windows relies upon using a 16-bit character, the WCAR type. However, both people, if they were to think that Unicode means UTF-8 or the WCAR character, would be mistaken. Those are simply two encodings in the Unicode standard. For example, there's UTF-32, which is simply the 21-bit Unicode bit stream, which is then zero extended out to 32 bits, which is the next logical word boundary. This is nice because it's a pretty simple encoding. Not a whole lot of parsing logic is involved. Unfortunately, it's also terribly inefficient because on a given character, you are wasting 11 bits. And you're also not taking into account that a lot of things that require those upper 5 bits are rarely used. So in the vast majority of cases, you're wasting a full 2 bytes of data, because what's most used is the lower 16 bits. So the next encoding is UTF-16. And for those of you that are Windows developers and are familiar with the WCAR type, it's actually a UTF-16 encoded character. And UTF-16 is essentially, for most characters, going to be a one-to-one mapping between a character and a zero extended version of that 21-bit encoding space. However, for things that require those bits between 16 and 21, it will use a multi-byte pattern, similar to what we saw with Shift just a moment ago. So what you would have would be 16 bits of data, which would be interpreted as a lead byte, followed by the 16-bit trail byte, and that would be one semantic Unicode character. UCS2 is similar, except it does not support those upper 5 bits. This is also used by a lot of legacy Unicode implementations. Again, the focus is on maintaining compatibility with the basic stuff you need, those lower 16 bits, which happen to be called the base multilingual plane, without having to mess with any of the lead byte, tail byte. The last two are pretty common. First, UTF-8 is an encoding that is always a multi-byte pattern. It'll take between 1 and 4 bytes to encode a single Unicode character. So if you're looking at something that is a standard ASCII character, it will require only 1 byte, which if you happen to be writing in English, or if you're looking at SQL data, SQL meta characters, or HTML meta characters, is very efficient because it's just 1 byte. As you move up into the upper parts of the Unicode encoding space, bytes will get extended to 2, 3, and 4 bytes. And those parts that require those extra 5 bits at the top are the ones that use the full 4 bytes. Most characters can be encoded between 1 and 3 bytes. UTF-7 is a Unicode encoding that was designed to be compatible with systems that only supported ASCII. So by that, every byte that is passed should only have 7 bits of meaningful encodings. It turns out that a lot of things like SMTP and older transports only supported ASCII, and so they had to have an encoding that was compatible with those. Which is why it's called 7, because it's 7-bit compatible. Now, one thing to keep in mind is, even though these are a number of encodings, and most people in this room have only been exposed to UTF-16 and UTF-8, all of these are going to be supported by most of the systems you develop on. One example I want to throw out here, as it will help out later, is UTF-8 encoding. So like I said before, if we want to encode a ASCII character, so one-to-one mapping, that Latin capital letter A from before, which is Unicode 0041, is also going to be the simple byte, 41. So there's no additional overhead required. If we want to encode a Japanese character, the half-width katakana letter A, which is Unicode FF71, that character will require 3 bytes to encode. And a parser that is going through and reading this byte stream will know, based on this first byte and the bit pattern in the highest or the most significant bits, how many trail bytes are going to be. So this EF specifies, hey, I'm a lead byte, and I have 2 trail bytes that are following. And then presumably there'll be a character after that, which a parser will continue on with. So there's the basics of encoding. Now, I mentioned a lot of examples of where support for internationalization, especially character representation, comes from. One big one will be from the operating system itself. If you're using Windows for quite some time, the core internals of Windows have been structured around UTF-16. That means anytime you send a piece of data to a Windows machine, it is eventually going to be converted to UTF-16. You can take that as a given. To say what internationalization support is in Linux, is a little bit tougher, because like all things Linux, it's very customizable. You can do what you want, whether you are the distribution developer or the user. But one internationalization thing you can take for granted in most distributions is that you will have UTF-8 string support. And that is dictated by the Linux standard base. So if you want to advertise yourself as being compatible with a lot of things, you got to at least support UTF-8 as your internal representation of strings. You'll also find that an increasing number of distributions will have UTF-8 set by default. In that case, you can usually assume that things will be making their way to UTF-8. But you'll never know until you look at what it's actually configured to be. Now, a lot of core support does come from the OS, but that's not the only place. Programming language that you go with often dictates your internationalization support, especially in the default scenario. I used one example from C a little while ago. If I'm a Windows developer and I choose to internationalize my software, then I have to decide to use the WCAR type as opposed to the CAR type. I'm demoing a tool here in a little while that is written in Python. And if I use a simple string, that will be interpreted as, well, a bit pattern, but for all intents and purposes, it's going to be a single byte code page. If I want it to be interpreted as Unicode, I have to explicitly specify it as such. So I have to go out of my way to support Unicode on a Python app. Similarly, Java and .NET have their own support, where their default string and char type is going to be Unicode compliant. Virtual machines, while we're on the subject of Java and .NET, also affect what is available, because they will dictate what the internal representation is. So by that I mean the Java virtual machine and the .NET CLR. And then all else failing, I can build internationalization in my application itself. So this will oftentimes happen if I'm writing in an unusual framework. I decide that I need to support customers outside of my original distribution, and I have to bootstrap on UTF-8 support or something. And I can do that by putting in a simple parser and not worrying about platform support. Now, because internationalization and support can come from so many different areas, I have a very unique attack surface. One internationalization bug can affect multiple operating systems, multiple applications, multiple classes of application, because it could well be that it's built upon a standard. That standard has a flaw, and it made its way into several implementations. So when looking for internationalization flaws, a great place to start is with the standards. For example, HTTP and XML, which both dictate internationalization. So starting from there, I can attack a broad variety of systems without anything that's application or platform specific. Now, every platform, whether an operating system or programming language or virtual machine, if it's going to provide services for internationalization, one of those core services is going to be character manipulation support. So what that allows me to do is accept data in one code page, convert it to another code page, and send it back to a user. So let's say, for example, I had a web page that accepted persistent data and allowed other people to search for it. You know, we could use Wikipedia as an example. Let's say a Japanese user browsed there, uploaded data, and it went into the database. I would know, for the most part, what that data was encoded as, because the HTTP request will tell me. Similarly, when somebody requests the data, I'll know what they want it in, and I can convert the code page from what the user, the Japanese user, had specified into something the English user can support. In order to map a given character between those two code pages, I need to have some sort of support, and that's the biggest thing that the character manipulation support will provide. Now, in that example, if I were making that web page, a sensible intermediate representation for all data I receive would be Unicode. Why? Because I can encode all the world's data in it. And so if I'm accepting something that's Japanese, say somebody sends me something shift disencoded, I can convert it to Unicode, store it in that, and when somebody requests something in, you know, a Latin code page and something that supports English, I just convert it to something that is English, and things like apostrophes will translate. Now, each platform that I've looked at in my time uses similar patterns for conversion. You'll have a few APIs that allow you to specify what the source code page is, where you want it to go to, parameters for conversion, because there are a lot of concerns you have to take into account, and then also just support for where the source information is located and where the destination should be for that data. So let's take a couple examples from Windows. The two big APIs for converting code pages are multibyte to widecar and widecar to multibyte. Now, multibyte to widecar would be the API you would use to convert data from something that is locale specific, like ASCII or the Latin 1 code page here in Windows or in the ISO standards. And you want to convert it to Unicode, because the shorthand for Unicode is widecar in Windows. So in making this conversion, I have to do a couple of things. First thing is the source code page, which is just an integer. And one of the things I can do with this, if I want to make my software broadly accessible to a broad, you know, an audience, is specify a constant for the code page, which is CPACP, which means use the default code page. And the default code page on an English build of Windows would be English. Actually, it's called Windows 1252, which is Latin. The default code page on a Japanese build of Windows is ShiftGIS, Windows 932. Which means that if I have the same built program and I run it on an English machine and I run it on a Japanese machine, this piece of code will behave wildly differently. Because on one, it's going to be interpreting things as a single byte code page. On the other is a double byte code page. DW flags specifies conversion properties. There's a number of these. Some of them are just for efficiency. But one thing to keep your eye on is error invalid characters. So I can specify if the conversion fails for a given character, return an error. Another thing to note is these last four pieces of, or last four parameters for the method. The first is a pointer to the source string. The second, or I should say the third, and then the fourth, is the count of bytes in that string. Notice it's not count of characters, it's count of bytes. This one is the pointer to the destination location, along with the count of characters in that string. A lot of people have gotten those calculations for count of bytes source and count of characters destination off. Sometimes it's non-trivial to infer it. And a lot of people make mistakes, assuming that the destination character will always be one byte. This is a common problem for American developers, or Western developers, because they're assumed to be working with code pages that are only one byte. And they're surprised when they have problems when they run on a Japanese build of Windows, and all of a sudden you have 2 bytes coming in. The next API is Wildcard to Multibyte. This is the API that you would use to convert from Unicode to a locale-specific string. Now, we'll have a lot of the same data that is consumed by this API. We have our friend the code page, which can still be that default constant. We have the flags, but they're a little bit different this time around. The big one you want to use here is no best fit characters. Now, a best fit character means that if I am using Unicode, and Unicode has support for a lot of apostrophes, for example, you'll have not only the straight up and down apostrophe from the ASCII code page, you'll also have those curly apostrophes. And if you're using a word processor and you type the apostrophe character, you'll see your apostrophes kind of curl in towards the sentence. Those are actually different characters. It's just not a trick. But if I want to encode that sentence as ASCII, rather than just dropping the characters, it helps to interpret it as the hex 27 apostrophe character. And that's called best fit. There's not a one-to-one mapping, but the apostrophe is the best you can do in the destination code page. Another thing to keep in mind is there's this default character. If a given character in Unicode, which is a huge code page, doesn't translate to anything in the destination code page, which could be very small, like a single byte, then you can say, well, substitute a default character, which is, you know, question mark or some other byte that specifies couldn't encode. Depending on what that is, it might have meaning in the destination string. You know, a question mark character is sometimes used to match a single character, for like in a regex or something like that. So keep an eye on how that works too. Now this is what happens when you convert between code pages and encodings. You put something in, you think you understand the structure, you get something out, it can be very different. And this is the source of a lot of the attacks I'm going to discuss in a moment here, I promise. Now, of the platforms we've already discussed, internationalization is pretty widespread, so you'll have some basic support. One of the tricky things is that Unicode is a varying standard, and so you never know what you're going to get. For example, you start off with Unicode, you know, 3.0. It specifies a certain number of characters. The next time you get an update to your operating system, or to your virtual machine, or to your programming language, you might find that it's added support for Unicode 4.0. So all the testing you did for security flaws against the entire set of Unicode characters is all of a sudden done, because there's a bunch more now. Now those newer platforms, ones that were designed in the era of Unicode, such as .NET and Java, use native Unicode encodings. It means you don't have to go out of your way as a programmer to have support for the full Unicode code page. However, they still allow support for converting to other code pages. The reason why is because you have a lot of legacy systems out there yet, and some of them don't support Unicode. So if you want to talk to them, you have to convert to something they do understand. So a lot of people, when I say some of my best practices later on down the road, hey, I use .NET or I use Java, and it has native support for Unicode. All of these encoding-based attacks don't work against me, so I don't have to listen to you, right? Well, that's where their support comes in, and the fact that they don't exist in a vacuum comes in. Every application has internationalization dependencies. I might also call them gradients. You know, as a web application developer, I might program in my old .NET or Java sandbox, and it accepts data from the web server, and it sends data out to the database or to a web service or mainframe. And both the data I accept and the data I send out may be in a different encoding than what I use for my business logic decisions. So from your development platform, you may have an internationalization boundary with your libraries, almost certainly with your operating system, or with your application server, or with your database server. And if you don't believe me on that one, go try installing your database again and keep an eye on those advanced settings called collations, which if you look closely, a bunch of descriptions about internationalization-specific stuff. And even once you get everything right on the server side, you still have those pesky clients out there. The ones the attackers are working on, they can usually specify any number of alternate encodings and code pages for the data they send. So because every level acts as an internationalization boundary, you can't count on the fact that because you as a developer do things right, that you are pragmatically secure. Because somebody above you or below you might be doing something wrong. And there's enough of an attack surface out there that I would say in the general case, you will usually find something. So this makes it important to remember that default code page we talked about on those two APIs earlier. If I use a default code page, my application will act wildly different depending on the build of the machine I'm working on or how I've configured it, because all this stuff is going to be configurable both on Windows and on Linux, not anything else that has support for internationalization. So I have to take into account when testing that I need to test on different builds, different configurations, because you never know who will be relying upon the defaults and how it will react when you send it bogus data. So a couple examples of how alternate encodings can be specified. I'll look at two standards. One is HTTP, where you have a number of places where my locale settings, my character encodings, and my code pages can be specified. Here inside of one HTTP post, which is from the demo I'm going to be giving here in a little bit, you not only have an accept language, it says, when you send data back to me, it should be English. When you send data back to me, it should be encoded with this code page. And the data I'm sending you is encoded with this code page. Never mind the fact that this is an abbreviated version. If I were to look at an actual request from a standard browser, the user agent string for that browser will also include information about the build that I'm using. Almost always it'll say English or Japanese. So that's an HTTP. And if I were an attacker and I wanted to try some of these attacks, I would start manipulating these and see how the server responds. Another standard, which you'll see all the time, is XML. And here on the first line of a given XML document, you have the encoding specified. By default, it's UTF-8, but like HTTP, what's actually available here is going to depend on the XML parser and oftentimes on the operating system, a number of other things. So you, if you were to look at a web service, an HTTP web service, you would have a number of different internationalization boundaries you could attack. Data is coming in from the top down. You know, the client or attacker is up here. The first layer it's going to hit is going to be the HTTP parser. And that's going to be something that is usually going to be what converts from UTF-8 to something else. There's a Unicode. Then it gets to the XML parser, where it may do yet another decoding based on what that document says. And at that time, it finally gets down to your application logic. You know, the stuff that you as developers would write that would say, you know, source account, destination account, transfer money. That's where most of us are writing data. And after we're done with it, it goes down to the database access library, JDBC or ODBC or ADO, before it hits our database, before it finally hits our operating system. Every one of these solid lines, there's an internationalization boundary, which means I might be able to specify my data way up here in such a way as to bypass input validation out here, or here, or here, and affect a change right here that might be security specific. If it's a database, I might want to bypass input validation so that I can do a SQL injection inside the database from the database access library. So when you're trying to protect against internationalization attacks, the key is to validate your data as low as possible in the stack. You don't want to check up at the HTTP parser above, because there's such a diversity of encodings that are going to be supported, it would be very different or very difficult to test for the full breadth of character encodings that these guys might support. It's a classic problem in the security industry. If we think about intrusion detection systems, IDS evasion has been a topic at Black Hat several times, and we're talking about the exact same thing here. I validate here, but this guy interprets it differently. And that's what many of the attacks I'll discuss are focused on. The most practical place for validation to happen is at the application logic. You have to take a little leap of faith and hope that these guys did the right thing. But that remains great research potential, because there's enough of these and enough supported platforms of them that there may well be a lot of bugs there to be found. So that was the background. I hope it wasn't too painful for everybody. Now we get to the fun part. The first is historical attacks. Now, security and internationalization have intersected before. Many of these now have best practices associated with them. Standards have been changed. You know, books have been written. And I would hope that these are lessons learned. And I said this at Black Hat Las Vegas. I actually believed it. And then with my luck, I found a bug in one of these two things the next week. So I guess you can't quite say it's lessons learned just yet. The first attack pattern that we have seen historically is incorrect width calculation. Now this will hit internationalization support in C, because that's going to be subject to buffer overflows most often. And we noticed those two APIs, those very ugly looking APIs, they had the count of bytes, the count of characters, a number of other hard to calculate or guess things, easy to mess up. And messing up those guesses has resulted and exploitable buffer overflows. You know, the kind of thing that, you know, have resulted in public security disclosures and, you know, nasty advisories and all that. It's hard to do. Not only do you have the conversion functions, which have the issues of count of bytes versus count of characters, which, you know, kind of a canonical example is to have an array which specifies a string, and people will say, hey, the size of that in terms of characters is just the size of parameter of that array. When in fact, in most cases, it's the size of the array divided by the size of the first entry into that array. Because if array 0 is 2 bytes, then this will be 1/2 the size of this. And a multiple of 2 is usually plenty to get your shellcode in 2. Another problem, and this is another example from the Windows world, is that there are a lot of compile time specifiers that dictate whether I am using Unicode or locale-specific code pages. And they want to make it easy for people to use both, to support applications written for both. The reason why, in the Windows world anyway, is because Windows 95 supported those old legacy code pages. Windows 2000 and above supported Unicode. So if you as a developer wanted to support both, it was easiest to use these compile time specifiers. The problem is, if I use these, I have to test on 2 builds. The ones that specify these strings are Unicode and treat them as such, and the ones that say these strings are locale specific, treat them as such. So you have to double your testing. Like I said, anything that goes wrong here is usually going to result in a buffer overflow. And it has. Oops. Now, there are best practices around trying to prevent such attacks. If you go and read writing secure code or a number of other things, you can see how to use those APIs in a safe manner. So hopefully we've learned that lesson and we can move on. The next is non-minimal UTF-8 encodings. So for an example of a non-minimal UTF encoding, walk through an attack. Let's start with considering an HTTP server, a web server. In its most simple form, all a web server does is it takes an HTTP request, specifies a file on the hard drive, reads that file, and sends it back to the requester. So an example would be, HTTP, my server, subdirectory web, and subdirectory index.html. Now, that request, web/index.html, will be mapped to the web root on that hard drive. It'll become a request for, we're using an example from NT4 here, so it'll go to c:// inetpub://www.root, and then web/index.html. So a common attack pattern against web servers is to try to break out of that web root and saying ../, ... and then another request would be a way of breaking out of that. It would be presumably successful. So web servers have to take this into account or else people could request, you know, ...../... you know, Windows repair Sam, and pull out a backup version of the password file, or if on a Unix system, ..... Etsy password. So this is something that most of us are probably familiar with. So then there's the fun part of trying to get that .... Past the input validation routine that tries to protect against these attacks. One could say very simple encoding for .... Is %2e %2e %2f. Now that is the URL encoding for period whose hexadecimal value in UTF-8 is 2e. We got another period, and then slash whose hexadecimal encoding is 2f. So together, that is a URL encoding of .... Input validation routine is probably going to look for that too, because that is the standard way of trying to provide data that may be interpreted in a direct way by the web server to it. So we say ..., URL encoded, and we get kicked out again. However, unusual encodings may bypass validation routines. Now, I mentioned before that UTF-8 encoding is a multi-byte pattern. A given character can be between 1 and 4 bytes in length when encoded in UTF-8. When a UTF-8 parser is reading those bytes, it is the first byte that dictates how many bytes should follow in that one character. And there's nothing that says we can't use a 2-byte encoding when a 1-byte encoding would suffice. All I have to do is zero extend the single byte, 2e, and then say this is now something that should be encoded for UTF-8. When I use a less than efficient encoding of this kind for UTF-8, it's called a non-minimal encoding. And so for hexadecimal 2e, a non-minimal encoding would be C0AE. So if I'm a UTF-8 decoder, I'll take those bytes, put them into a bitstream, and it will come out as the period character. And it turns out the input validation routine in NT4 IIS, which found requests that look like that and kicked them out, it found requests that look like that and kicked them out, but did not identify requests like this that would use %C0AE, which is the non-minimal encoding for period, followed by another C0AE, followed by C0AF, which is the non-minimal encoding for hexadecimal 2F for the slash character. So using this pattern, you could request anything off of the hard drive on which the web root was located. And it was, you know, a bulletin was released for this. So people found that this was a bad thing, and that there is no good reason why any UTF-8 decoder should accept things of this format. It's not only a security risk, because you have to validate not only that, that, and that, and then the 3 and 4 byte equivalents of that, but it's also far less efficient. No legitimate client would want to send 4 bytes when it could get away with 1. It wastes space. So the Unicode Standards Committee made UTF-8 non-minimal support illegal. And all that means is that if you want to advertise yourself as Unicode compliant, you can't support UTF-8 non-minimal encodings. Now, what you do with that, if you're writing a UTF-8 parser or decoder, and you come across a non-minimal encoding, you have a number of choices of what you can do The only thing they say is he can't decode it. And what a common option that people choose is a subject of an attack. I'll go over here in a few minutes. So those are the historical attacks. And like I said, I would hope that those are lessons learned. The times when I remain, or when I continue to see them, when people didn't read those books on how to properly calculate width of source and destination strings, or when they're writing their own UTF-8 decoder, rather than using the one that might be provided by a platform. So if I had to suggest two best practices to not follow in those people's shoes, it's always read the documentation on the APIs you're using. And please don't roll your own UTF-8 decoder. So let's move on to the current attacks. Now these are attacks that I've seen in systems in the wild for the last few years. And I have seen some public disclosures along these lines, especially with the third pattern, the encoding attacks. But I've seen less of the other two. And I hope to evangelize getting these type of attacks looked for, so that all of our systems can be more secure. So this first occurs when you're converting from Unicode. Now we were looking through that internationalization stack before, where you had the web server, then the XML parser, then your application logic, and the database server. This pattern is applicable when I validate input, and the input is in Unicode, and then I change it to something locale specific, like Japanese shift JIS or Latin 1. And the attack class is to use best fit equivalents. Now, Unicode's character space is much larger than any locale specific code page. I should say any standard. But Unicode has a full 21 bits of encoding space, 16 bits of which are pretty well used. And most locale-specific pages are going to be 8 or at best 16 bits, but even then, the full 16 isn't efficiently used because of the multi-byte pattern. So what you end up with is a many-to-one mapping for many characters. Now, the example I said earlier is if we are writing in a word processor and we type a quotation mark before and after a sentence. You'll always notice that you won't get the straight up and down quotes, you'll get the curly ones. And if we want to convert that document to something that is in ASCII, and you want to be able to have those curly quotes become real quotes, or ASCII quotes. Because it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to just drop those characters, because then you lose the fact that that is a quotation. So the Unicode standard specifies a number of best fit characters. Now obviously this isn't going to happen for one place and time character. But you will notice that most ASCII characters, especially the punctuation, will have multiple best fit equivalents. Now when I'm converting from Unicode to a given code page, the best fit equivalents that will be specified is going to depend on that code page. If I'm converting to ASCII or even to a Latin 1 code page, then there will be a number of Unicode characters that will translate to a given character in that code page. The reason why is because that single byte code page is simply not large enough to include several options for a quotation mark. However, if I'm converting from Unicode to Shift JIS, there are options available. So the best fit will probably be something else in the ShiftGIS code page than the ASCII character. Now you can take your time to go and identify the entire set of code pages that are supported by your application and by your platform, and set up a test matrix that will address all of them. Or you can specify, depending on your library, please don't use best fit characters. And I'd recommend that, and I have a demo to show you why. Now, one of the characters that is a good best fit target would be the prime character. Now, the prime character looks like an angled apostrophe, but its Unicode code point is 2032. You know, far different from the Unicode code point for apostrophe, which would be 0027. However, if I convert that Unicode prime to Latin 1252, which is the Windows code page for on an English build of Windows, it will best fit to hex 27, the apostrophe. Same thing happens for quotation marks, numbers, letters, most things in the ASCII code page. And like I said, Latin 1 isn't the only code page. I had to remind the American audience of this one. There are many other supported languages as well, and code pages. Now, who cares if that prime character becomes an apostrophe? Well, if the data that you are sending, that an attacker is sending to your application, is going to make its way to a database, you sure do care. Because that prime character, Unicode 2032, which is converted to Latin 1252, will become an apostrophe, and will go to your database access routine. Now, if you validated your data up here, looking for stray apostrophes, and escaping them out as necessary, and then you go through this process, you're very likely to have a SQL injection on the tail end. If you think about it another way, this character is one of a number of apostrophe equivalents that can be used in support of a SQL injection. Now that's what happens if you use this in the context of database access. If you use it in the context of, you know, HTML, the same thing can happen. I can send a quotation mark-like character, which will allow me to bypass validation inside of an HTML tag. Or maybe a less than sign, which allows me to bypass input validation and write out full script tags. So really, this kind of an attack will work against anything that does a best fit conversion, does validation before that, and then has some sort of an interpreted language on the tail end. So let me show you an example, just to prove I'm not lying about this. I have here a very simple website that I use for testing and demos. It's actually a .NET web service, and .NET allows you to generate this HTML page for testing. And so at the backend architecture, I have four methods that I can launch. I can log on a user, I can log them off, I can view their information based on a cookie I get when I log on, and I can update that user's information. Let's go through a quick example of legitimate usage. The logon method, like most logon methods, takes two parameters, the username and password. And I have a very strong password today. When we log in, you'll see that I get a very strong session identifier, 1000. If I want to identify information about that user, I just type in that cookie value, And you can see that I'm Scott Stender and I live in Seattle. So that's how it works in general. Now, when I log on, like a lot of web applications, it uses the name and password that I give it to look up a row in a database. And it executes a SQL statement, select star from users, where name equals whatever the attacker specifies, and user and password equals whatever the attacker specifies. I'm sure many of you are familiar with SQL injection. Quick reminder, if I can manipulate that statement, then I can do a number of nasty things, like log in without a password, or affect change the database, or depending on the database, even run system commands as the operating system. So I'm an attacker that knows about SQL injection, and I know that most applications will simply, fill an exception or do something else nasty. I just type an apostrophe after the name. And so I do that and type in my same name with an apostrophe, and I launch it. And now all I got was a legitimate response, -1. Now in the context of my application, -1 is an invalid session identifier. It maps to nothing. So it looks like they validated that apostrophe, didn't just throw it into the statement, and didn't result in a SQL injection attack. However, we talked about the best fit equivalents. The application, the first thing it does is it looks at the username, and it does a search and replace. It looks for every apostrophe, replaces it with two apostrophes, and then sends it on down the database. Now, I do something particularly dumb with this application. I do an explicit round trip to Windows 1252. So that some apostrophe-like characters will convert to apostrophe. Now, this is a concocted demo, and so it would be something you would hope not to find a developer actually doing. But what you do find them doing it in is the context of talking to a legacy system on the back end. You know, I have to go talk to a mainframe, or I have to persist it in a file on the machine so I can read it out later, or any number of other things. So, we saw that Unicode 2032 was a best fit equivalent. And there it is, 2032, the prime character. So if we copy and paste that into the form instead, and then invoke that, then we get our exception. Because I validated the data first, then converted it, then sent it to the database, that apostrophe became, or that apostrophe-like character became an apostrophe, and now it looks like I have a potentially exploitable SQL injection. So I'll do the canonical attack here. Apostrophe-like character, or 1=1. Comment out the rest. So the request now looks like select star from users, where name equals empty string. Or true. So that request to the database will return the entire user's table, and now we'll log in as whoever's first in the list. So there we go. I didn't get a -1 this time. I got what appears to be a very strong but legitimate session identifier. And if I go to print info, type in 1001, the session identifier I just received. And there I am as somebody named Root. So here we've used best fit equivalents. Let's see. Here we've used best fit equivalents to bypass input validation and get a SQL injection. Now, this isn't something that's only going to be a concern for SQL injection. Like I said, it can be in cross-site scripting or anything else that's interpreted. And it's also not something that is only going to be a web app attack. I've seen a number of attacks against, server applications that are, have nothing to do with web apps. They're susceptible to this. Oftentimes, you might even find more attack surface, because a lot of times such things will allow you to explicitly specify what code page you're coming from, and which one you'd like to go to. A little tip, if you ever see that, then you're in good. So the next attack pattern is when I validate my input, and it's a locale-specific string, and then I convert it to Unicode. Now the attack pattern here is called eating characters. Now many languages, or many code pages I should say, and encodings, rely on a multi-byte encoding pattern. Japanese shift JIS, which here, you know, Japanese builds of Windows support by default, as well as UTF-8 are two examples of variable width byte patterns. Validation routines will often identify and escape characters as appropriate, just like the one I described a moment ago, where I look at my string that I receive, I look for apostrophes, I double them up, and then I move on, send to the database. Now, if I could find a way, when I convert to Unicode, to eat one of those apostrophes, now if I'm doubling up an apostrophe and I can get rid of one of them, then I get right back to a potentially injectable scenario. And it turns out we can use multi-byte encoding schemes to do this. So a converter will identify a lead byte, interpret trail bytes accordingly, and you know, then it will go into Unicode as a single character. So what happens if I send up just a lead byte by itself? So in ShiftJIS we looked at the 8-1 lead byte with the 8C trail byte, and that was some semantic character. What happens if I just send 8-1 by itself and say that is a ShiftJIS character? Well, I can eat a SQL quotation character. So if we start off here, we have hex 8260. It's the full-width Latin capital letter A in the ShiftJIS code page. Now, that's the lead byte. That's our trail byte. So what happens if I say hex 82 lead byte, hex 27 trail byte? Well, that actually is an invalid character. There is no such thing mapped. There's no hex 27 trail byte in the hex 82 lead byte. So, you know, we'll just encode to failure. It'll oftentimes just become a question mark. So what happens if I say hex 82, hex 27, hex 27? Well, these two guys together will become one semantic character because it's a lead byte, and that'll become the question mark. And then I'll leave the 27 behind, which will be that. So if I were to send this three-byte pattern up to a ShiftJIS decoder and have it go to Unicode, then it would become these two Unicode characters. So if I did this, if I did this to the select star from users statement, start off where select star from users where name equals O. Henry, you know, so my family's Irish and we're the bane of input validation people because we have to have this apostrophe in our names. So if I wanted to be able to put O. Henry into a database, I have to escape that legitimate apostrophe by putting an apostrophe before it. So if I submit a last name that ends in hex 82, then I'll get a select star from users where name equals O. Henry, and then this little apostrophe here that is supplied by the application to finish off the statement gets eaten by my hex 82 lead byte. So if I say hex 82 apostrophe or 1 equals 1, then what I get is select star from users where name equals O. Henry. That'll get doubled up, eaten, and then I have my or 1 equals 1 back. So using a lead byte trail byte pattern, I can eat characters when I convert them to Unicode. I use example of ShiftJIS where you can eat a single character, which is plenty if you want to bypass SQL injection protections. But if I were to use UTF-8, and I had something that was converting from UTF-8 to UTF-16 or something like that, that is a 4-byte multi-byte pattern. So I can eat up to 3 trailing characters. So this is something that I've actually seen more often on Japanese applications than I do on American ones, simply because, or I should say, applications written, running on Japanese builds rather than applications running on English builds, simply because so much of your data is going to be coming in, perhaps interpreted as something locale specific, and then must get converted to Unicode to be interpreted in the Windows operating system, because everything goes to UTF-16. So if something is taking in a standard locale specific byte stream, it's going to go to Unicode. And if you just specify that read byte before something that you expect will become an apostrophe, or a read byte and then an apostrophe, you're likely going to hit something here. So that's the second attack pattern. The third one, which the security community has really started to rev up on in the last year, is encoding attacks. And this is when validation is performed on input, and then we change it to an alternate encoding. Now, the previous two attack patterns relied on changing between code pages, where one semantic character became another one, or if during the conversion process I was able to eat characters. That's a cross-code page concern. This one is just cross-encoding. You know, if I'm going between two encodings of the same code page. And the attack class is foiling canonicalization. Well, that's one way it can be used anyway. But the IS4 vuln that we discussed earlier, with the lessons learned historical attacks, it required that the non-minimal encoding for the period character, C0AE, be interpreted as an actual period character. Like I said, there's an easy way to fix it. Disallow non-minimal encodings. And like I said, the Unicode standard has indeed been changed. But what do you do with those illegal characters? A lot of times, you don't want to throw an error. And this is, I shouldn't say that. I would love if they threw an error, but a lot of people don't, because it is going to be a severe functional impact. A lot of systems are built on not being internationalization aware. And that's fine, so long as you are just reflecting bytes. If you don't really care what encoding is coming in, and you don't really care what encoding is going out, then it's fine if it looks like, you know, garbage to the wrong client. And that's why a lot of people don't want to throw errors, because they want to allow, you know, what might look like garbage character to an English client, but would look appropriate to a, you know, a Japanese client that has an appropriate code page. So you just instead fail silently. So most UTF-8 parsers today, when they choose to fail silently, do so by simply dropping the character. So I used to have, you know, C0AE within my request, and then it gets dropped to nothing. Doesn't fail, doesn't become a period, which is good, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're out of the woods. And go through our example of the web server again. Now you have a request for index.html on the web page. You have alternate encodings for that, and it's easy enough to validate for them. However, instead of using non-minimal encodings to encode a period, what we can do is to use non-minimal encodings to bypass pattern matching. So any one of these validation routines is going to look for dot dot slash. Well, what happens if I specify, instead of dot dot slash, dot percent C0 percent AE dot slash dot percent C0 AE dot slash whatever. When that gets decoded, the UTF-8 decoder will often say, hey, that's non-minimal. It's not valid. And they kick it out, and it's going to drop it. So what happens is it drops all that, and then the non-minimal encodings, where that request without the non-minimal encodings, becomes dot dot slash dot dot slash again. Exactly the thing that we didn't want to have it become. So we found yet another way to bypass input validation in a general sense, using non-minimal encodings. And I'll show a demo of this. It's not particularly sensitive, from a security perspective, but it does illustrate that this will happen by default. And I'm sorry, I have to go a little outside of the pretty demo to show it. because I have to use a non-minimal encoding and I have to put that on the URL. So this URL that I just cut and pasted into here is going to perform the exact same logon user functionality that I demoed earlier. It's just a request based through the URL as opposed to through a post. And to show that it's the same thing, I can say user equals estender and pass equals $cot again. I'll cut and paste that real quick. Oops. Uh-oh.
SQL demo ASMS. Logon user question mark.
Ah, there's my problem. The curse of the live demo. All right, so this should log us in. And indeed, we get a valid session identifier. I hope you'll trust me that that would successfully return an entry if I were to go to print user with that. So here we have my valid username and password. And I'm going to type in the middle of my valid password, %C0, %AE. Now here's two full bytes of data that aren't my password, that aren't anything that's SQL injection related, that you would hope a validation routine that looks for name and password is going to hit. But indeed, when I hit that, I still got a valid session identifier. Why is that? Because before my data got to my actual business logic, which in .NET, the string that I receive is going to be the .NET string type, which is Unicode. It has to decode that UTF-8 byte stream. It says it's non-minimal, says it doesn't want it, so it kicks it out. And the password that actually gets my business logic is going to be, you know, my legitimate password. Now, here, who cares? I mean, I already know the password. It's not a big security issue. But if this was something that was doing file path canonicalization or anything else where bypassing a pattern match is going to be good for doing bad things security-wise, then this is an attack pattern that can help people. The final encoding attack. Actually, I made a mistake. I was off on my slides earlier. This is the attack that has seen a little bit more attention in the security community of late. And I'd call it mistaken identity. We have been spoiled by most common Unicode encodings. Unicode is just a set of code points, but encodings have been structured to be ASCII compatible. So if I look at UTF-8 or UTF-16, they all resemble ASCII or zero extended ASCII. UTF-7 looks nothing like ASCII. It's actually, you can just simply base64 data, add a plus and minus to the beginning and end, and then that will, you know, that could be a script tag or anything else, and if something is going to interpret it as UTF-7, then it would bypass any input, any validation routine that was looking specifically for script or apostrophes. And you can use this to sneak garbage data past validators. And actually, just this week, Microsoft released a bulletin for IIS that allowed for broad cross-site scripting attacks because IIS would allow for data to be reflected off of it and be interpreted by UTF-7 as UTF-7 by clients, and you could put cross-site scripting payloads in there. A couple other bonus attacks. Well, I'm out of time here. But there's a couple of other things that aren't character-related that you could use to attack internationalization. Most interesting is timestamp attacks, where 10.05.06 could be interpreted as October 5th, 2006, or May 6th, 2010, depending on whether you interpret the year as the first bit or the last bit of that string. And from a security perspective, your ticket expiration check might want to know which one that is. Because if I have the next 4 years to try to break a ticket through brute force, that's a lot better than just today. Also, I have one quick tool that I want to show, and this will be my last bit. But also, basically what it does is it automates testing for the types of attacks that we discussed here today. Because there are a lot of characters, a lot of encodings, and one day I hope this tool will help people test for both. I intend to release it soon when it's ready. It's right now an early alpha version, but if you're interested, You can please take my business card after today's meeting. I'll be back at the table, and I'll be happy to email you when it's available. But it's simply a HP post and get parameter fuzzer based on the attack patterns we discussed here. It's called I18 in attack. When I run it, it will attack the web page that we were just using for demo and come back and tell me about anything that looks suspicious. It takes a couple seconds to run. It generates a lot of test cases. So here we have HTML input or output. You'll notice that some of these encodings that are best fit equivalents, CAB9, CABC, these are two UTF-8 encodings for two Unicode characters that best fit to quotation mark. And you'll see that it found in the return data that there is an unclosed quotation mark error returned. And you can see the request and response that generated this. So if I were to run this tool and I would see these things hit, I would know that it's time to investigate those requests or those characters in more depth. So that is the end of the presentation. Sorry, I went a little bit over time, but I hope you all enjoyed it. And I will be out in the back here in a moment to answer any questions you guys have. Data in the back there, a lot to get through. Sometimes I was going too slow, and I could hear them quiet, sometimes not.